What a very prompt audience you are. You were all up the stairs and I was still chatting away in the kitchen. So I had to scurry upstairs. Anyway, yes, you're all very, very welcome to our latest edition of Desert Island Retreats. And tonight we've got Achara here to play us his discs. So I've invited Achara to choose the 8 music tracks, a book and a luxury item that he would choose if he were to be cast away on a desert island. And I think most of you in the audience, looking at the audience, will know Achara. Some of you very well, some of you not so well. Some of you maybe not so well at all, I don't know. But so Achara is a long-standing member of this Sangha, one of the key individuals that, we may not be sitting in this building if it weren't for Achara, actually. Achara was one of at the vanguard of getting this building up and going. It was a big move. So before we were here, we were in quite a small rented property in Broom Hill. That's right, isn't it? I wasn't there, but yeah, I'm looking at the people that were. And so it was a very big, ambitious move to, and a big project to buy this enormous building and all the land and get it up and running. So, yeah. And I think you did that pretty much as soon as you were ordained. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So we'll hear a bit more about that later. So Achara is still very, very busy with Intraratna. He may not be around the centre at the kind of front of house, if you like, quite as much, but he's very, very busy in the background, being a private preceptor, and I think you're a trustee for the Triratna Trust, aren't
you? Yes. Yeah. That's the Order Charity.
The Order Charity. So very important. Yeah. So it's just fantastic to have Achara here, to get to know him a bit better. I've really enjoyed, we've had a pre-interview about a week ago, and I really enjoyed getting to chat to him and getting to know him a bit better, and I hope that you all enjoy that as well. And he's got some cracking tunes for us. And the other thing that I should say is that he's a real music lover. He takes music really seriously. And so there was quite a bit of talk about whether he would bring his hi-fi. He's very good hi-fi. and was the music quality going to be good enough? I think we've just, Paddy, we've just about passed muster, haven't we? Just about. So music is really a great passion of Achara's. So I think we're going to enjoy hearing his tracks. Yeah. So, shall we get on to the bones of the interview? Achara, you were born in Glasgow in 1959.
Yes.
That's right, isn't it? And you were called, you were named John Jeffrey.
My name is John Jeffrey, named after my father.
Yeah.
Who's also called John.
Also John, yeah. So do you want to tell us a bit about your early life?
Yeah, so when I was 1 year old, we moved to Paisley, which is a town, I think, to the west. Well, I don't think I know. It's to the west of Glasgow. We lived in I think it's called a maisonette, on a very busy main road. Mm. I was a bit of a trapped animal until I got a push bike. You know, it wasn't possible to play. The school was a walk across a very busy main road. So I lived a slightly solitary life. Bringing to mind the reason for my first track, one of my strongest memories was houses were very cold in those days. Mm. There was only one room.
No,
one or two
heating.
Rooms that were heated, yeah. So you'd all fight over the fire, the gas fire.
Yeah.
And I remember on a Sunday, it's one of my earliest memories, you know, we'd all be in the lounge together. We weren't always allowed in the lounge. We had a gramophone record player. And it was always classical music. My mum and father never listened to contemporary music. They were quite austere. I think I benefited from this, but they were quite austere East Coast Scots. And this was the West Coast, but I think I had a heavy East Coast Scottish influence. Anyway, we'd pile into the lounge and there would be classical music on. And it was a juxtaposition of being cosseted by the warmth and being with the family, but also feeling that trapped animal. But above that soared the music, which I just found extraordinary, that emotions could be moved and beauty could come out of a small black gramophone.
So and why in particular this track? Shall we say what the track is?
So the track is a Beethoven piano sonata.
Got an issue with the sound. A bit louder.
Could you turn me up? I'll speak up as well. Oh, there
shall
we go.
Shall we alter your mic? Would it be better on the other side? I notice it's catching a little bit as well. Yeah. Is it better like that? I don't know. That might be worse, actually. Sorry. Yeah.
There we go. Is that better? How are we doing? Good. thank you for drawing attention to that, because I do have quite a soft East Coast accent, Scottish accent. Okay, so we're all good with the sound. So the first track is Beethoven's Eighth. I've chosen this one. It could have been Dvorak's New World Symphony, but I've chosen this one because it was the music that my mother and father were married to. And it was also the music that was chosen for my dad's funeral that I led. So it's probably my mother and father's favourite piece of music.
Thank you. Let's wrap the track. Thank you. Thank you. See, there were musicians in your family as well, weren't there?
My father's mother and father used to sing professionally, and so my dad grew up with a piano and music and singing. But we weren't, I think that had sort of been lost. We weren't a musical family in the sense that I played an instrument. Well, I played a recorder. There's a bit of a story behind that. I'll just share this quickly. So I could sing. I sang in Gaelic, used to compete in the national mods and singing in the Scottish language. But I found the whole experience nerve-wracking. But the most nerve-wracking experience was when I succeeded in dropping the whole choir by two or three places by coming in on the wrong count. And that was... and then being shamed publicly by... And not that I needed it. I felt terrible being publicly shamed for this. So I think that actually killed something in me for quite a while. The story's not finished, but it meant... whilst I had a deep admiration and wonder about music and the particularly composers, I just can't begin to imagine that process. I, at least at this stage, I wasn't musically committed.
Sure. But I suppose interviewing you last week, I had a sense of, if you could be musical or if you could express yourself in music, that's kind of, maybe a slight regret for you?
I've always envied musicians. Okay. Although we come, this is jumping ahead, but yeah, I will jump ahead slightly. Yeah. I took up the saxophone midlife.
Yes,
and that was like rewiring my brain. Yeah. And I had to deal with a little voice that kept saying, "You're not musical."
Okay.
I just asked it to wait outside the room while I practiced. And actually, I got to the point where I was busking in Chesterfield, and I could play the Pink Panther and all that sort of stuff.
Very good.
So maybe we'll revisit that. I'd love to have a strand of DNA in my genes, but that wasn't my life.
Mm. But the miracle of recorded sound
that's another story. So, and that's an important part of my life. So just staying with this front room and this gramophone that I remember vividly, the wonder of a recording device and musical. I used to crave a tape recorder as a little boy, and it was an era. Where things were analog. I'm getting a little technical here, but you could become obsessed with wow and flutter and, the quality of the amplifiers. So that was a very early interest in devices that can capture beauty and reproduce it.
Okay. Well... we could probably move on to your next track. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you came to?
Yeah. So this next track, I felt almost is renegade the word, almost renegade because I don't know how they came into my possession. But Myra, who was a teenage schoolgirl downstairs, I seemed to acquire a load of her records. I don't know if they were gifted to me or what, but anyway, I had this pile of records. And we're in the mid-60s. And
so you were quite small.
Yeah, I mean, I would have been 6 or 7. So alongside Sparky and his magic piano and Peter and the Wolf, I had the Beatles and a few American artists. And I don't think this is just nostalgia. The period 1965 to 1975 were an amazing period where British artists conquered the world. And things moved very quickly. There was electronics, guitar technology, recording technology. And we were still in the LP. And I want to capture something of the beauty of listening to an LP was you couldn't skip tracks. It was a samatar. It was a concentrating experience. And there was a bit of a ritual. You know, you had to clean the needle and you had to get the weight of the needle right. And if it wasn't right, the whole thing would pop and crackle. And I just loved this. You know, you participated in a performance. So I had these records that I found it difficult to believe that these songs, which were so elegant, hadn't existed in time and space before they were written down. So the next song I've chosen, I only discovered this when I chose this record. Actually, that is what happened. This song came to the writer in a dream, and he checked with several musicians as to whether this song existed, and was told nobody had heard it, so he claimed it as his own, but it appeared in a dream. So that's the next track. You'll all know it.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Mm-hmm. 2 minutes and 5 seconds. That's all you need. Okay. So, a lot going on in the mid-60s for you, kind of being captivated by the new wave of music. But you were also off to the East Coast quite a bit to see your grandparents.
Yes, so that was a very pivotal, very important influence in my life. So my grandparents... my father's dad had died at a very young age, but my mother's mother and father lived in Arbroath. The first thing that struck me about Arbroath is I saw blue skies for the first time, because you wouldn't believe how wet the West Coast is compared with the East Coast. Okay. So you had these reds. I remember going into, you know, the state of rapture, just at red sandstone houses and blue sky. But I used to... and it was a big deal, you know, it was only 3 or 4 hours drive, but in those days that was a big deal, the car may or may not make it. And, anyway, we'd, you know, we'd go to Arbroath, and my grandad, the Gourleys, they lived in a council house, and my grandfather was a blue-collar worker, but he worked on the trawlers, and he worked for the in the agricultural sector for the farmers. So you had these tall stories about going to lighthouses. And they loved him. You know, the fishing community trusted him. But he was a great influence on me because he was an inventor. Mm. He developed a depth sounder to find fish for the trolleyman.
Oh, wow.
He got stopped during the war because he was developing radar on his own.
Oh, wow.
He built a Spitfire that used to fly around the garden with my mum in it. So she was on the movie town, and then he'd make clocks with little dolls playing the piano, you know. And I think I have that curious inventor type nature myself. But this was a big influence on me. I did discover one principle of the universe through him. So he'd work on clocks and watches. And I remember he gave me a watch, you know, to take to bits. I discovered it's much easier to take things to bits than to put them back together. There was this moment of horror that never left me, and I haven't forgotten that it's easy to take things down. Yes. But actually, the process of creating and building, yeah, it takes a lot more skill. And then simultaneously, my father wasn't an engineer, but he was an accountant. But he worked in a factory that made fishing rods and air guns, Diana air guns. They were taken from the Germans after the war, and they were built in Scotland. And I used to have my summer holidays in this factory, so I'd meet these legendary characters like Mr. Moss, who was inventing a pellet-making machine, you know, for air gun pellets. So I just knew from a young age that I'd be an engineer. I had an early fascination with how things work. Really admired good equipment. And just in passing, I'll mention, again, this was quite an interesting era because my father gifted me an SLR, a single-lens reflex camera, and this was a Japanese precision instrument. And it was like holding a bit of an Apollo space rocket in your hands. Things were still pretty basic, but there were these high precision devices. And again, this was another capture device. So cameras became my currency of love, in that they could capture something of beauty and replicate it.
And there was a creative process there as well.
Yes, yeah. Okay, I've come to see about myself. Give me a blank sheet of paper and I'm not that good. But give me an arrangement of things and I'll show you how to make it more beautiful.
It's good to work that out, isn't it? Okay, let me turn the page. Where are we up to? Oh, well, we've got quite a lot to say here, haven't we?
There's quite a big... you'll have to listen to me a little longer because... Before we go on to the next track represented a very significantly different phase in my life. So, you know, remember this is the mid-60s. We're heading to the early 70s, the very early 70s. I didn't realize how badly this had affected me, but I was a quiet, philosophical kid. And inner city Scotland, Glasgow, Paisley, isn't an easy, it's not an easy gig. So I was systematically bullied because I was brave enough to fight, but I didn't want to hit anyone. So, of course, I became easy pickings. And then on top of that, and only worked out a few years ago why this happened, I was also the most strapped, one of the most strapped kids in the school. I worked out more recently that that's because I was one of the few children they weren't afraid of, because the middle school I went to was actually dangerous. I thought manslaughter and arson were normal behaviours for children. My last day in Scotland, I should say, this was the middle of the early 70s where there was an oil shock and millions of people were chucked out of work. And my dad took a defensive move and took a job with a food company. His theory was people would have to eat. And we moved to Yorkshire. But when it was discovered that I was committing the crime of moving to Englandshire, I was told I'd get razored. So my last memories of this school were leaving an hour early.
Okay.
This affected me more than I realized. Mm. Combined also, I think it is important to mention my life story. My dad was in the Suez campaign, and he got hit by a grenade badly traumatized.
Mm.
And he carried that to the grave. Mm. So he was a good-tempered man, but he was volatile and unpredictable.
Mm.
And so between bullying and really not being interested in the things most people are interested in, like football, or, you know, I was a bit of a lone wolf, really. Mm. But a move to Yorkshire, this was just incredible.
Mm. So things looked up.
Yeah, it was really amazing because we moved to a house that was detached, and it was in, you know, there was a bit of greenery behind it. And it was the days of direct grant, so you could, with merit, if you passed an entrance exam, you could go to a school. And I didn't realize the sacrifices my mum and dad made to send me to this school. But anyway, I went to this Leeds Grammar School.
Okay.
And it was like the contrast was just extraordinary because it was like Tom Brown's school days, you know, and people are wafting around in big gowns. And,
okay.
and
you'd just come down from Paisley.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't, apparently I was barbaric because I didn't realize my life wasn't still in danger. It took me a bit of time to catch up.
Yeah. So you went around like this.
Well, in the meantime, I'd learned that the protective use of force means you don't get bullied. So I'd learned how to hit people.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the trouble stopped. Yeah. So it was maybe not necessary, but anyway, it gave me some respite. But what I my joy was there was a library. You know, this school was founded in 1600 or something, and there was a library full of Kant and Russell. Mm. And I was on a search, looking back. You know, I was on a search. I didn't understand most of what I was reading, but this was just so fantastic that I could access these thinkers, not be so concerned for my safety.
Yeah.
So lots more to say. But anyway, this was I'll talk about some of my other searches and adventures. But this next track represents, this was the early 70s, and buying an LP was actually quite a big deal. It was £30 or £40 in today's money, so you could get an LP a month if you were going well. So the ritual of getting it out its wrapper and playing it, and then this sound world, I think if we move on to the next track,
Should we play the next track and then we'll talk about who it is and about it? Yeah, let's just play it. Some of you will know it.
Thank you. and then one day five. 10 years have gone behind you. No one told you when to run. You missed the starting gun.
From Dark Side of the Moon, classic album from the early 70s.
Yes. I just realized sitting here that your first album was like a coming of age.
Absolutely.
Because in our household, you know, my parents wouldn't listen to contemporary music. Mm. It was classic, and unless you heard it on the radio, you know, the ability to just go and buy an album, it was a big event.
Yeah.
And then this song, which the whole was greater than the parts, was a sort of symphonic, thematic concept album, which was in the top, in the close to the top of the charts for 19 years. This was so this really, you know, it sort of defined an era. There were many other artists of that caliber, but it's just taking me back to the excitement and the pride at buying an LP.
I think you compared it to your first girlfriend.
I did, but we weren't supposed to give that one away. Just in case there's any girlfriends in the audience.
Well, that segues quite nicely, actually, doesn't it? Yeah, so you were a teenager at Leeds Grammar School, listening to music, spending your time in the library, and what else was going on?
Well, three big things happened during this period. I mean, first of all, I loved, and I do love Yorkshire. I love the people. They're like a more refined version of the Scots.
Ooh.
I'll be in trouble.
How widely is this going out?
I'll be in trouble. Trouble with the Scots for that. But yeah, so there was three sort of threads to my life at this phase. I mean, the first thread was my love of physics. Like a physics lesson was like a Dharma class for me. I just, it was no effort, and I just used to have bodily rapture being in physics classes. But I remember once we were doing Hooke's law. That's about elasticity of things, you know. So we're looking at, you know, I'm looking at this ruler. And I thought, it's all very well, this. It's all very well. It's very interesting. But there's a law that unifies the whole of the universe, and I'm going to find it. And I knew with absolute certainty that I would. And I'll come back to that thread. The other magnificent unfolding in my life was... for the first time in my life, remember, I didn't play football. I wasn't sort of physically, you know, I didn't play games like the other kids. But I fell in love with the hills and rock and the mountains. And there's some of the highest quality rock climbing in Britain in Yorkshire on the Gritstone. So I started climbing, and you know, one of the discoveries I made was I started, you know, being freezing like a rabbit, you know, 5 feet off the ground on a 45 degree slab and having to be rescued. And, you know, 3 or 4 years later, I'm soloing hard, very severe and extremely severe climbs. And I discovered people can change. And that if you guard the gates, if you learn to guard the gates, because there is this great paradox in rock climbing that until you're flying through the air, you're perfectly safe.
Okay.
But if the mind wavers, you may well go flying through the air, because it's very much a head game. And also that the concentrated mind is the happy mind. So I'd say climbing is, I would now regard it as a dangerous and inefficient way of getting concentrated. I prefer meditation. But you do pay attention when your life's in danger. And life becomes very vivid.
Yeah.
And you become, again, paradoxically, surprisingly, become very relaxed. Mm. So you have these strange experiences.
Mm.
So I became a mountaineer. I climbed in Scotland, Iceland. I put out a new route in Iceland, named after my favorite album at the time, Close to the Edge by Yes.
Okay.
Went to the Alps, climbed the Matterhorn, and South America.
And this is all in your mid to late teens?
Yeah, I was at my peak. You know, this was early teenage, you know, going up to 1920.
Okay, yeah.
So that was one, that was a second thread, and then I promised a third thread. But I'd like to come back to that thread after. Yeah, I'd like to come back to that thread after this track, because I chose this track. I talked about Close to the Edge as, Dark Side of the Moon as a concept album. There was another concept album at the time, which was Tommy the Who, which I was very, very tempted to choose, because these characters, they were very interesting. They were studying Eastern religions even back then. And Pete Townshend of The Who, what I loved about him was his audacity. He said, play me a beautiful chord and I'll play you a more beautiful one. And I trusted him on that. So it was this, you know, I sort of sensed these guys were actually musically trained and they were doing something very interesting. So. So I've chosen The Who for that reason. I've chosen The Who because I loved their energy. It captured my adolescent energy. And I've chosen the next track because, jumping ahead, when I was a married man with a son and a daughter, Hannah and Ben, this was one of their favorite songs. We used to play it in the camper van as we drove to Morocco and Norway and places like that. So in honor of Hannah and Ben and The Who, the next track is Behind Blue Eyes.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man, behind blue eyes. No one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies. But my dreams, they aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be. Learn is vengeance that's never
Theme.
So we've got two threads going, yeah. Which I want to say just a little bit more about, and then there was a third thread. Mm. So I was a mountaineer, and I was very blessed. It was very auspicious that for whatever reason, many mountaineers seem to know of Buddhism, particularly mm. Zen Buddhism. Mm. This was a time, even in the 70s, it was there weren't so many books, and unless you bumped into a Buddhist or unless you sought a book out. But I was given a book by one of my climbing friends, Alan Thompson, called The Wisdom of Insecurity by Alan Watt.
Okay.
And I read that, and I only pieced this together years afterwards, but I was on a search, like most people, like typical of the human condition. Underneath it all, there was an unhappiness and a suffering. And looking back, it's like I sort of knew I'd lost something. Mm. Tried very hard to be a Christian. I've come to have quite an admiration for aspects of Christianity, but I couldn't surrender to the form that was introduced to me. Mm. Although I did succeed in winning the Hooke Theology Prize for an essay on why you should be an atheist. and also, and this was quite mischievous, really. And I only worked this out years later. The three teachers I deeply admired were all Christian. Mm. And one of them, Mr. Hansen, I used to tell him I was interested in the occult and I was going to do a Ouija board session. So this completely set him up, because what he'd do is he'd bring in a load of exorcists to to try and terrify me as to why you shouldn't mess with the occult. But of course, this just fascinated me and egged me on, you know, not into the occult, but into actually there are some quite mysterious aspects to the universe. So I was on a very sustained search looking back. And remember my physics lesson. I realized that I'd found perhaps the spiritual law that lay behind everything, which was conditioned co-production. And I knew that I didn't understand it. And I knew that the Buddha was definitely the most profound teacher the world had ever known, or it was a wild goose chase, and I didn't know which. But I was reading the Dharma from a young age.
From quite a young age, yeah.
So that's one thread. The other thread was mountaineering. Those two go together. But the third thread that entered my life delightfully was I do have a quiet voice that occasionally speaks. And this quiet voice said, there's somebody very important you're going to meet in the next couple of weeks. And as soon as I set eyes on her, I recognized her. I said, there she is, and I'm going to marry her. And that's Fiona Lomas, who became Fiona Jeffrey, who's Moksha Leela.
sitting in the front row.
So
glowing slightly pink.
So, and it's been a real good journey. It's not been without its thrills and spills. You know, for whatever reason, that quiet voice that I never failed to listen to spoke wisely. So, and we shared, Fiona, she was her family were a revelation, amongst other things. Her mum was lovely and a brilliant cook, and they lived under Almscliffe Crag. So I could look on my favourite crag, and they were a much more relaxed and fun-loving family than my own rather austere and serious East Coast. Got no criticism of them, but Moksha Leela's mum and dad, who've come to be very important in my life. It was like entering a different universe. And we largely shared musical taste, and there was one track that became closely associated in my mind with Moksha Leela.
So we're going to hear that now. We'll play the track and then we'll say what it is. Yeah.
I caught a glimpse of in the night.
Afterglow by Genesis.
Genesis, yeah. Mm.
Do you want to say anything more about the track?
I'd like to say something about the fact that every single piece of music we've played, I've seen performed live, apart from the Beatles. And again, sound like I'm quite aged or dated now, don't I? It was that era where you had to queue for a day or two to get a ticket physically. And I worked out it was more efficient to turn up with an attractive woman on your arm and ask to be let in for nothing. So actually it became a very successful hobby. Like I saw all these bands. Usually missed the first two or three tracks, but that was a small price to pay.
Wow. Okay. Does it still work now?
I haven't tried for a while, and Mokshalila never enjoyed the experience as much as me, but she found it rather stressful. But but it works. Yeah. And it was much more efficient than queuing for days for tickets. So so that was Genesis. And so maybe, shall I move on to sort of after university? And,
yeah, well, you were... Yes, I mean, you trained as an engineer?
Yeah, so I did an engineering degree. I was clear I wanted to be an engineer. The North Sea was booming, so I worked offshore as a construction engineer. Loved it, flying around with helicopters. I'll tell a very quick story. So, oh, no, I won't. Yes, I will. Used to go for a beer with the helicopter pilots, you know. And so I knew them all, you know, we'd be flying offshore. And I'd say, I've heard these helicopters are fully aerobatic, but I don't believe it. And they'd say, no, they are, honestly. I said, I don't believe it. You can't loop a helicopter. And eventually they'd turn the voice recorder off and we'd loop the helicopter.
Oh, wow.
That's why I hesitated, because I don't want to get anyone in trouble. But so it was brilliant.
You can't imagine looping a helicopter.
It was just brilliant. You know, we were, and they were called, to make it better, they were called Bond helicopters.
Okay, so of course.
I hope there's no legal action against Bond helicopters because of this. But anyway,
perhaps we edit this bit out.
it was a wonderful phase, because it was moonshot technology. You know, we're putting jackets into deeper and deeper water. It was a real place of adventure. But I wasn't particularly cut out for corporate life for a variety of reasons. And I really wanted to run my own business. And my dad said to me, well,
if you can drive a little car, you can drive a big car. Mm. So why don't you start a business? Mm. And a moment of serendipity, this man walked into my life, Mike Freeman, who was, he had so many traits similar to Sangharakshita, my teacher. Mm. He was the Sangharakshita of the business world, tough, but good. And he walked into my life just at the time I wanted to launch a company using mountaineers to do the most difficult work offshore.
Oh,
and he said, well, I want to launch a business doing that. Uh-huh. I said, well, I've got a job for you and I want a job. So I was employee number one, chief exec, managing director at 25. And the thing went off like a rocket. And we transformed steeplejacking, the way work is done at height, which is traditionally very dangerous, and very expensive, and scaffolding by the waterline of a jacket could be washed away. So so I had a decade of building this company that became an international group. It's still very big. And apparently if I'd not discovered, become so committed to the Dharma, it'd be worth £100 million. So best £100 million I ever spent. So I had a decade building this company. But if you remember the threads of physics and the Dharma, and I'd done everything. You know, I'd married the girl I wanted to marry, had two beautiful children, lived in a lovely house in the country, and I'm running a company. And, you know, there was still this hurt inside. I still wasn't happy. And, you know, it took a little bit of effort to hear and listen to that voice. But looking back, I was on a search. The beginning of the resolution of that search hasn't been resolved completely, by the way, but knowing that I was on a trajectory that will, in time, resolve things. The beginning of that journey was the Alexander Technique, where I discovered that telepathic communication can happen, and that if you pay attention to the body, surprising things happen. And also, I'm a great believer in states of relaxed concentration and productive effort. So I was working very hard, and in the evenings, I now know what was happening. As you surrender from hard work, actually, I would have spontaneous experiences of jhana. So I was ripe for something to happen. And I searched for 20 years for a teacher. I rejected every teacher I found apart from the Buddha, who I would not yet accept. But I couldn't, I didn't have grounds for rejecting the Buddha. So I'll say a bit more. I'll pick up that thread in a minute. But it'd be a good time to play the next song, which was, it's Mala's number two. So I was in the money at this stage of my life, and I could indulge my interest in hi-fi. So I had a hi-fi that was worth as much as most people's car. And this was, and we'd moved on in technology, of course, to the CD from tapes and CD. And anyway, one of the reasons this track is chosen is I bought this expensive system and then realized I had no CDs to play in it. So there was only one in the shop, and it was Mala's number two, The Resurrection, you know. And I played this thing, and I couldn't make head nor tail of it. Anyway, it was all I had, so I played it about three times that night. And then I'm sure I'm not the only one. Just all of a sudden, it's like, what did you not get in that piece of music? And if there is a soundtrack for the Dharma, this is the closest, because I remember mischievously playing this in my very good sound system in my expensive German car. returning from a Vajraloka retreat when we'd all been in Dhyana for a couple of weeks.
Oh, wow.
I said, let's just run this little experiment.
Okay.
Somebody who is now the chair of the Berlin Center said, do you remember when we left Vajraloka and played Mala's number two? He said, I'll never forget that.
Wow.
So here's Mala's number two.
you could make head nor tail of that, but
beautiful.
It reminded me of the principle that one has to learn to listen. Mala wasn't popular in his lifetime. Mm. I have a theory he became popular after the recording device was invented. Because some music you have to learn, even to listen.
So you were a businessman. You were hugely successful. Everything was going right. But you still weren't quite satisfied with how things were.
Yeah.
And you'd found the Dharma, but...
Well, in an intellectual form and a very tentative way. Mm. So the threads in my life during this period were, just to touch on music very briefly, classical music, some jazz, playing the saxophone. But still on a very, very ardent search across the world's teachers. The three teachers, two of the teachers who spoke to me, funny enough, were evolutionary teachers, Sri Aurobindo and Tayar Dushardin, the Catholic. But anyway, it was still very much, apart from the Alexander technique, it was still very much an intellectual quest. Anyway, that changed dramatically. In a business meeting, funny enough, on the Rock of Gibraltar. So I need to go back 2 years before. I had a very strong dream where... a hand came down and simply said, and of course, this is Spain, across some water. So I woke up and I was asking Fiona, like, what country borders Spain across water? And she said, well, I don't know. So there is, I've seen it as a country. Anyway, I'm top of the Rock of Gibraltar, and this hand comes down and says, and of course, this is Spain. And I got... I'm looking into the sun. There's a little tip if you're ever very concentrated. I'm looking into the sun and I got hit by a realization experience where I knew I was a Buddhist. I knew the Buddha was my teacher and I knew the Buddha was pointing at something far, far more profound than mere words and that there was an escape. I came back. It was terrifying, I think, for Fiona, because I said, everything's changed. Everything's going to change. I don't know what that's going to look like. So then I went, actually, I'm really pleased to be able to mention the sister-in-law who died at a young age. But the sister-in-law of Fiona's best friend, Susan, so Susan's sister-in-law, Magu, I bumped into her and she said, oh, I've just come from Taraloka. And again, it was this era where if you didn't bump into a person or a poster, you know, it wouldn't. As far as I was concerned, there were no Buddhists in Britain. I was the only one. So I bumped into Magu and she told her I was a Buddhist. And she said, well, are you meditating regularly? And I said, well, I give her a really corny answer. You know, my life is my meditation. And she said, well, that might be the case. It might be in your own case, that might be true. But for most of us, you know, we need a teacher. You should consider the FWBO. So I phoned Wisdom Books. I had this brainwave that I'd find a center by speaking to Wisdom Books. So I phoned Wisdom Books, said, are you prepared to share your mailing list with me? Why are you asking, Mr. Jeffrey? Well, I'm looking for a Buddhist center. So if you just look where most of your books are going, then, you know, maybe I can follow up. Well, there's somebody called John Jeffrey in Barlow in Derbyshire. He looks like a Buddhist center. So, said, no, that's me. So that didn't work. Anyway, I called. I think she said, well, they've got a centre in London. There was such a thing as directory inquiries. So I phoned London. I said, oh, well, it's funny. Two teachers have just rolled into Sheffield. Oh. So I wrote to Amoghavamsa. This is what it was like in these days. And he wrote back, said, oh, you'd be very welcome. You know, we're running a class at Mappin Street. So I turn up with my pilot's briefcase. I'm qualifying for a plane at that time in my little Super 7 sports car, which was about 100 decibels more than it should have been. And so I roll up to this class. But I'm still in a state of quite high concentration and very deep Shraddha. Anyway, I walk through the door and this famous little voice says to me, you go through that door and your life is finished in its current form. Are you ready for that? Clearly I was. So I walked through the door and then there's this guy with a ribbon round his neck, this tall guy. And the voice said, shut up and listen. He's practicing. And then I got on the cushion and the voice said, it started. Tree Ratna's, FWBL Tree Ratna, has just been a very happy and miraculous home for me. There's always frustrations and dissatisfactions. But as soon as I heard Sangharakshita speak, I knew that he knew, and I knew he was my teacher. And I knew I'd been waiting for him. So that was the Dharma. But things got pretty bumpy. I had a fairly elegant mental breakdown within 2 years. And tried to find a way through. You know, I didn't gladly give up our wealth or a profession and company I loved. I don't know if there's a spiritual law, you can't have both, but if it's possible to have both, I would have pulled it off. But it wasn't. So I went forth, in quite a dramatic way. In one sense. So that
took me. So you left the business. Yeah,
so I left the business. And, the rest for the next 20 years, I sort of cobbled together some part-time earnings and contributed to Tree Ratna and got a lot of time on retreat. So I asked for ordination. We were beginning to come towards, I was about to say the present day, actually it's not that present, we're still 25, 30 years ago. I've just had my 25th anniversary in India. I was ordained in India with Vidanya.
So that was in 2000.
In 2000. And these were really magical times, Advaya Chitta, Punyamala, Sioux City. It was a tiny, tiny assembly of us. And I'm really glad. I'm really glad it was like that, because immediately I'm emptying cushions out of estate cars and helping take paper, post-it pads down off Mappin Street. I felt a participant very quickly. Maybe that hasn't changed, but. You just felt very quickly felt part of it. It was a small sangha. So I was ordained in India in 2000. I'll tell you about my name in a minute. How are we doing for time? Are we all right? What have we got left?
Just gone quarter to nine.
Okay, 10 minutes.
We've got two tracks.
Well, I've got time for a quick detour, a very quick detour. So my first class, we got asked this question, why have you come? And, I wrote down disillusionment. And this went on the post-it pad. And the Amoghavamsa claims he doesn't remember this. But he just ignored it. Because I assume at the time he just thought, well, I don't know what to make of that. That's a very negative comment. But I was serious. I came through that door to be disillusioned. Because I'd had moments of temporary breaking through the illusion. I should mention that as a mountaineer,
you know, when in rarefied atmosphere in the beauty of mountains, and with physical exertion day after day and limited food, actually the world becomes pretty thin and you have little breakthroughs where suddenly things are very, very clear and obvious. And, you know, so this, so I knew that's not the state I'm in. So I really did come to be disillusioned. I wanted the illusion that causes us suffering to come to an end. So anyway, that was the Mappin Street class. So I was ordained in India by someone many of you know, a man I love, Padmavajra, and Subhuti. I couldn't ask for two better preceptors. They're both pretty hardcore, and I need that to stay in line. And the name I was given, Achara, means unshakable or immovable. It also means in Gaelic, good friend. It also means mountain. And it also means, those who know me well will laugh at this, arguably it also means no car.
No car, eh? without a chariot.
Yeah, without a chariot. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the ninth boomy for me, I confess.
You like cars. Yeah.
I like good devices. It's just a tool. here's the important thing about my name. I was given the name because Padmavajra read about an engineer called Achara, or a project manager, who had restored the Ajanta caves several centuries ago. And that's why I was given the name.
Oh, wow.
Of course, that placed a spell on me because within 12 months, we're negotiating and buying, I negotiated to buy this place when the Twin Towers were hit that very day. When I was going around with Triodos bankers. And, you know, this was an amazing project, actually. We were very, very lucky. I, you know, was in a position to give it some time. And so I didn't do it alone, obviously. But, you know, it did take a steady nerve. And it, there was, you know, there was some ambivalence as well around taking on a building that had an iconography that wasn't Buddhist. But I think we've traversed that very well, and I think most people would agree this has been a good home. So,
absolutely, yeah. But a very ambitious jump, I think.
Yeah. Well, for all of us.
Yeah, for all of us.
I was very pleased that. You know, it came together.
How amazing
that
group of you had the vision to pull it off.
Yeah. I'm going to share one more thing quickly that just occurs to me. I've got few regrets in my life, but one was that I acquiesced to a Christian marriage when I wasn't a Christian. And I didn't really give this sufficient thought, but it was just a little bit of a niggle, you know, because I wasn't a Christian. And I think you have to take rituals seriously. Anyway, Moksha Leela and I went through a pretty bumpy period in our life where we dissolved our Christian marriage and recommitted under a more dharmic understanding of commitment and companionship. And Punyamala led a ritual in here. And the poetic elegance was that something that had bothered me, the fact that my life unfolded in a way that I became remarried in a church that I'd helped convert to Buddhism. and, you know, it's just, it's... Am I doing something with this?
You're catching your case
is that
on the mic,
that's the banging. It just shows the power of intention and that, you know, a human life does unfold where, when clarity emerges, events follow. So
absolutely.
So we got recommitted here.
Lovely. Shall we hear your next track?
Yeah, so the next track, I don't listen to as much music as I used to, and my musical taste has changed, but there are two bands, one in particular, for reasons I don't fully understand, I've never outgrown. I really love their music. And the music's principally by somebody called Ian Anderson, who's a Scot, and it's a sort of folk rock. I could choose so many tracks, but I've chosen this track because I really love the words, because one of my practice arenas is the dream world. I take the dreaming world as seriously as the waking world, and I have clear intentions to practice in the dream world. And I've come to the conclusion that the waking world is more dreamlike than we like to think, and that the dream world is more real than sometimes we like to think. But if you listen to the words, it's called The Waking Edge. I think it's indirectly touched on. Anyway, Jethro Tull, I love so much that once when I was in the middle of the Amazon jungle and I discovered they were playing in Sao Paulo that night, I insisted that my hosts take me to the concert. they said, look, we're just too tired. We can't do that. So it doesn't matter. I'll go home. No, you don't understand. It's too dangerous. You won't get home alive. No, you don't understand. I'm going. So they made me promise to pay for a taxi to sit. They said, once you get inside, you'll be safe, but you need to promise us you'll have a taxi waiting for you. So anyway, I went and saw Jethro Tull in Sao Paulo.
Sao Paulo, Brazil.
And survived to tell the tale. So.
In my hotel room, we're still here. hesitating. They seem to linger on as the streetlights fade and the empty dawn is breaking.
Coming to the end, aren't we? Yeah,
this brings there's two bands that have followed me through. The last track that I'd like to play is a band that came across about 25 years ago, and they're a Manchester band. They were a friendship group that have been together from school. And I really admire melodic beauty, and I think I just really want to commend them as amongst the most melodic of bands. And also, it's been a soundtrack. It's been a soundtrack of the last few decades. I was introduced to them by a very important friend in America. Mochalila and I had an amazing trip to an arboretum in the south of England and had them live and came back. And then this track I've chosen, I think it's got a melodic beauty, but it really speaks to the unspeakable tragedy of most human lives at some point. And it, for me, it's captured with a Japanese haiku-like beauty. The background theme is a train, and you can hear in the syncopation and the drums, you can hear the train. But it's our family were visited by a terrible tragedy in the last couple of years. It just speaks to that too, but more widely for me, it speaks to, and I find this an inspiration, by the way. It captures the very serious tragedy of a human life if we don't pay attention, and that you won't find many people who are more enchanted are more committed to the world than me. And at the same time, nothing can work in a mundane sense. So I don't know if I can succeed in communicating the paradox and the contradiction that to be enchanted and committed and fascinated. the theme of my life, the signature of my life has been wanting to understand how things work from the physical world to the psychological to how social systems move, how political systems move, to ethical laws, which I believe an ethical law does exist, the law of karma, and even to what makes a transcendental insight more likely. So the trajectory of my life has been a fascination and a commitment and a curiosity. And I've loved my life. And at the same time, nothing can ultimately work. So I think this, other than a commitment to the three jewels and in the context of that bigger project, everything becomes more beautiful and less painful. But anyway, this track captures unspeakable tragedy of some human lives, including our own family from time to time.
I know this, I've played in this dirt, powdered glass over everything, spray paint swastikas and cocks, coke cans bleached by soil, sir, why here in the filthy flight at Bramble Hill? There's canic blue man's river song, mile just down the line. First class tux, more coffee, more apologies. Pale faced kids in rubber gloves, dressed as cops outside. I try to find your name, you didn't make the news, you're just the man whose blues stopped his heart beneath our shoes.
Of that track is the delayed 315 from the album of Giants of All Sizes by Elbow. Powerful track. So, I'm about to cast you away on your desert island. Are you going to survive?
Well,
I suspect you will.
Yeah, physically. Physically, I will. Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, I don't know how, you know, I don't get on so well with being on. So it won't be easy. I'll just have to course the Dianas and correspond with non-fleshy beings. But I don't find being alone, it's not what I choose.
Are you practical?
Very.
Can build a shelter and all that?
I'll just be fine.
You'll be fine. Fair enough. Okay. So I'm going to give you a copy of the Dhammapada.
Thank you.
And I've become very generous. I think initially I was just giving Shlangaratcha's memoirs, and suddenly with Satyajyoti I started giving the whole complete works. That's very generous of me. So you're going to have your work cut out to read it all, the compendium as well. And yes, but you can also take another book of your own choice. So what's it that going to
be? Well, if you had offered me this, it would have been this.
Oh, I am going to give you all of it.
It would have been this. Yeah. But given I have this, including the Concordance.
The Concordance, that's
which
the word.
Is a work of magnificence, which you should all buy.
Yeah.
You really should. So as long as I get the Concordance as well. I want the largest book I can find on chess and the history of chess and problems.
Okay.
Because I love that world. I haven't talked about it, but it's a whole universe for me. So.
Well, you need a chess set as well.
I could probably get by just, you know.
Just reading, thinking about it.
If I'm allowed a chess set, I'll have it.
It struggles.
I'll make one. Okay. It'll be fine.
And what about your luxury item?
A camera.
Camera.
Yeah, I'll take a camera. Yeah.
Okay, you can certainly have a camera. Yeah.
Thank you.
And so finally, which track would you save if the discs were being swept out to sea? Which one would you run after?
It would be the Genesis track, which is a requiem to unrequited love. Mm. And there'll be plenty of that alone on the desert island. So. And it would remind me of Moksha Lila. So, so I'll take the Genesis track.
You can have that. Yeah. Atra, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your desert island discs. So, and applause for. Thank our tech team here for just being great and
without a
hitch. Fantastic. Thank you, Paddy. Thank you, Melissa.
Sorry I wasn't better with the mic. For a sound engineer, I didn't do so well. So.
And thank you to the audience for coming along.
I've written up the six tracks for anyone who, the eight tracks, for anyone who's interested. So I'll put it on a chair if you want. They're there.